Story County's county attorney has decided the use of deadly force in this week's shooting of a chase suspect was justified. Nevertheless, the chase that resulted in the death of a young man raises many questions. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll describe what happened on that deadly high-speed chase in Ames and discuss the questions it raises with IPR's Joyce Russell. Also this hour, Iowa State and Ames Lab engineers develop real-time 3D teleconferencing technology. Gold Star honors for two Iowa veterans, and a look at the Wild Rose Independent Film Festival. It's a Friday News Buzz edition, right after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the program on this Friday. Coming up later in the program, Iowa State and Ames Lab engineers develop real-time 3D teleconferencing technology. We'll hear about that. Also, Gold Star honors for two Iowa veterans who died in military service, and a look at the Wild Rose Independent Film Festival toward the end of the hour. But first, the Ames police officer who shot and killed a 19-year-old driver on Monday during a high-speed chase was cleared yesterday of wrongdoing. In just a moment, we'll discuss the questions raised by this chase that resulted in the death of a young man. But first, what happened? Yesterday, the Ames Police Department posted the dash cam of one of the police vehicles involved with the high-speed chase of 19-year-old Tyler Comstock. We have the audio of that video. The video starts with the dash cam pulling up behind Comstock at the intersection of South 4th Street and University Boulevard.
Shouldn't be at South 4th and University. I don't see the vehicle plate. I just have trailer plate 5528, number George.
Comstock is driving a stolen truck with an attached two-wheel metal grate trailer. It's the kind you might use for landscaping. Comstock starts to speed up near Jack Trice Stadium. The officer puts his siren on. Police say Comstock was traveling nearly 70 miles per hour during the chase. Sure looks like it on this video. At this point, he takes a sharp right, blowing right through a stop sign on Beach Avenue, going north towards campus. Some items fall off the trailer, but Comstock keeps on driving towards campus. When Comstock nears Stevens Auditorium, he reverses and rams the police vehicle.
Just ram my vehicle.
A heavy piece of lawn equipment falls off the trailer. But Comstock keeps going, blows through a red light at the intersection of Beach and Lincoln Way. That's a main thoroughfare through town and an area with heavy pedestrian traffic. He narrowly misses a vehicle and is now on the ISU campus. Comstock speeds past the business building and the Memorial Union. You can hear other police sirens off camera.
Just blew the stoplight at Lincoln Way and Beach. Blew the stoplight, Lincoln Way and Beach. Still northbound, just lost the trailer.
A voice on the police radio, a supervisor, suggests backing off because Comstock is driving so recklessly. Luckily, there aren't a lot of people outside.
I'm coming down, ramp about 13th. If I can get a location, I'll stop.
Comstock drives onto the lawn in Central Campus near the campanile. His truck knocks over some signs. The supervisor on the radio again suggests backing off. Comstock then turns around, facing the dash cam, and rams the pursuing police vehicle again. Comstock reverses and drives backwards, away from the police vehicle, in a grouping of trees. Two other police cars follow and ram Comstock in quick succession. Comstock's truck bed cover falls off. Comstock rams another police vehicle off camera, but you see the debris of the vehicle go flying. Then, also off camera, seven gunshots are fired.
What you got on him, 88?
Hey, 88, we got shots fired. He's trying to ram us again. Shots fired.
Is he still in the vehicle?
We have one. He's unresponsive in the vehicle. Vehicle is still running. We are in Central Campus by the campanile.
events unfolding very quickly there, as you can tell by our little narrative. Less than 4 minutes passing from the time that chase began at 10:25 a.m. on Monday, when the police officer, the police were aware of that just north of the Campanile on ISU's campus. They fired 7 shots in the back of Comstock's pickup cab. 19-year-old Tyler Comstock died from 2 gunshot wounds. Joining me now to discuss this case, Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
A lot of discussion about this, obviously, a tragedy. The Story County attorney, Stephen Holmes, looked into this. What did he conclude?
Well, according to the police report, the officers fired into the cab in order to prevent the driver from putting them and the public into any further danger. And in a lengthy letter to Ames Police, the county attorney concluded that on that basis that the shooting was justified.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, a lot of reaction from the family. What has been that reaction to the police pursuing Tyler Comstock of Boone? This was after his father reported the truck stolen. So Tyler Comstock stole James Comstock's truck, and this is when it all started, a truck belonging to a lawn care company.
That's right, and the Des Moines Register has interviewed the family, and according to their reports, they're outraged and baffled mm-hmm. by what happened.
I can even quote from the Des Moines Register article, James Comstock refused to buy a pack of cigarettes for the 19-year-old Tyler, and the Des Moines Register said, quotes, the father is saying, he took off with my truck, I call the police, they kill him. And it was over a damn pack of cigarettes. I wouldn't buy him none. I lose my son for that. You can certainly empathize with the pain of a father in this case.
Yeah, it's very tragic.
So there is the case, and we just heard some of the audio from the video released by the police from that dash cam. We heard twice, and I think this is one of the questions that's being asked, that the police officer supervising the chase, we hear on the radio suggesting twice to back off. Has that been addressed?
Well, I asked about that at the news conference yesterday, and Commander Jeff Huff, who's the police commander, Ames PD commander, who's handling public relations on this incident, he said that the officer did slow down as they entered campus, but they kept their lights and sirens on, they say, as a warning to the public. And then with the second communication, the supervisor suggested the chase could be called off because they knew who the driver was. And the commander said the officer was in the process of getting out of the car when that transmission came down. The commander said he doesn't know if the officer heard it mm-hmm. or not, but at that point he says it was too late to disengage.
And of course, if you watch the whole video, we had a condensed version here with my narration. If you go to our Facebook page, we'll have the link to that released by the Ames Police. And just watching that 5-minute video, Joyce, I think you'll agree, you see that the positions that police officers are put into to act incredibly quickly, make incredibly quick decisions, and what the question arises was, what made the police officer fire his weapon in the end?
Well, the news conference that they had yesterday was Ames Police and the DCI, and it was quite restricted. They said, we'll take 5 questions, and they meant it. I was in the process of asking another question, and they said, that's it, and left. They did, however, unveil the DVD of the chase, so there was that kind of transparency. But what I had wanted to ask is why the officer did not disable the vehicle, in other words, fire at the tires or mm-hmm. some such, rather than into the cab. I sent that question by email to the commander shortly before we went on the air. I received an email response. He suggested that I direct that question to the Law Enforcement Academy.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Joyce, do we know what happens next here?
Well, the officer involved is on routine administrative leave. And, of course, the closing of the investigation does not preclude any civil action that the family might take. The other question I had hoped to ask yesterday is the department confident that they could withstand a civil suit? I did ask that question later of the city manager who was there. He said, we're not thinking about that now. We're thinking about the family and the officer involved.
Okay, Joyce Russell, thank you for joining us on today's edition of River to River. Thanks, Joyce.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition of our program on this Friday, an edition where we buckle up and cruise through some news quickly that we didn't get to in the other part of the week. This past September, Guido Barilla, he's the chairman of the Barilla Group, which makes Barilla pasta and has a production facility in Ames, said on Italian radio, "We don't include gays in our ads because we like the traditional family. If gays don't like it, they can always eat another brand of pasta." Well, you can imagine the firestorm this set off on social media. Around the world, in just a few minutes, a boycott of Barilla pasta. A campaign was set up, spread quickly around the world, including in Italy and here in the United States. Since making those comments, Guido Barilla has apologized, saying that he has, in his words, the utmost respect for gay people and all loving families. The company has also pledged to present more inclusive advertising and recently created a diversity and inclusion board. Joining me now is Joel Geske. He's associate director of the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication, where he specializes in advertising. We want to discuss how Barilla's comments could affect his company's public image and his profits. Joel, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Tell us, first of all, how problematic can comments like those made by Guido Barilla about homosexual couples and parents be for a company?
Well, this is a problem that has been going on for years. Target did this some years ago, not very long ago. One of our own Iowa companies, Blue Bunny, had the same problem where they were supporting stridently anti-gay political candidates. This happens quite often, and I think it's unfortunate because this is a large and vibrant community with a lot of spending power, and just from a business standpoint, it really doesn't make much sense to alienate one part of your market.
Mm-hmm. Do we have, in this case or any other the cases, you mentioned the Target, the Blue Bunny, of the quantity, the measurable damage that was done or can be done?
I think that's really hard to measure. We do have some statistics from some research that's been done that one in particular, 42% of heterosexuals say they'd be less likely to buy a product if it was advertised on an anti-gay program or there were anti-gay sentiments. So, you know, between the gay population of maybe 7 to 10% and another 42% of the non-gay population, you're looking at half the market maybe that would be offended by these kinds of comments.
Mm-hmm. Public opinion across the country has changed very rapidly on this case, becoming more and more supportive of gays, of the LGBT community. I wonder, would Mr. Barilla's comments have caused so much controversy if it was even 5 or 10 years ago that he had done this?
Actually, the statistics that I just gave you were from about 2006 or so, and some of the we haven't had any later data since then. So even 5 or 6 years ago, there was still very strong support for the gay community.
You say the data is from several years ago, nearly 10 years ago. We've seen a lot of change since then, so we can expect that the data to support LGBT friendly advertising and rights would be even stronger today?
Oh, absolutely. I think we see that when you see the current polls for support for same-sex marriage and things like that, that support for the gay community has just grown tremendously over the last few years.
If we can forecast that into the future, 10 or 20 years from now, how will we look back on these times, do you imagine, in the advertising world especially?
Well, you know, I think we can always learn from history. And you look back in the 1960s and the early 70s, and interracial marriage was looked at very negatively. And today, if you were to say that to young people, they would just be aghast. I mean, it's just become so socially acceptable. And so I think in 10 or 20 years, you're going to see that same kind of reaction.
Joel, you mentioned that this demographic, the gay community, is definitely has some buying power. You don't want to offend them if you've got a product. So just how much buying power?
We can look at the census data, and it shows that as far as a national index, they're twice as likely to be professionals or managers. They have a household income over $85,000 on average. They're 3.5 times more likely to have a household income over $250,000, so that's quite affluent. And we find that the gay and lesbians report in the census data that they live in 99.3% of all the U.S. counties. So it's an audience that is spread all over the United States, and it's quite affluent.
In the wake of his comments, Guido Beria's comments, a social media campaign took off. It satirized the company, urging people not to buy Barilla's products, a boycott. Talk about social media in advertising and the social media impact in cases like this.
Well, I think the social media, and especially things like Facebook and Twitter and things that are very immediate, just make it very easy, number one, for the community to find each other, and it can create a firestorm very, very quickly, sometimes within a matter of hours. One person will pick up the story, and it can spread across social media very, very, very quickly, much faster than it used to. In today's electronic media, this can create a crisis for a company within hours.
In industry magazines, when we talk about advertising, do insiders in advertising say, we've got to change our culture here?
Oh, I think absolutely. If you look at all of the major Fortune 500 companies, almost all of them reach out and are very supportive of the gay and lesbian community. It's just a sign of the times, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think Barilla's actions, promising LGBT-friendly advertising and this new diversity and inclusion board, will help mitigate the damage that was done?
I don't know about that. I think people have long memories. You know, Target, it's been several years, and there's still a lot of people that will boycott Target because of their perceived, I guess, their comments that they made at the time. I think that something good can come out of this if they've included this inclusivity board, if you will, or something, you know, and they can become a case study for other companies on how to avoid this kind of controversy.
Joel Geske, Associate Director of the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, thank you very much.
Pleasure to speak with you today.
Now is perhaps a good time for a little mea culpa on the part of Iowa Public Radio. On Wednesday's show, Politics Day, you may have heard a reporter use the figure $30 million to describe spending by Americans for Prosperity in our most recent local elections. I picked up on that figure as well. The group did indeed spend money on the mayoral and council races in Coralville, but a spokesman for the group has declined to say how much was spent. And it's we're not sure what it says about our country's politics when a number that big, $30 million, didn't seem preposterous at the time. Millions, no longer an astounding figure when it comes to elections. But when we pause to think about it, we realize the error. And in fact, we thought with $30 million, you could, for instance, pay tuition, room and board for 2,300 undergraduate students at Iowa State University for a year. Or $30 million represents the entire state budget for the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship for the fiscal year 2012. And it's also the amount spent by Americans for Prosperity in a national campaign to defeat President Barack Obama in 2012. We apologize for that slip-up. Before we take a short break on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, when we first heard about this next story, it reminded us of that scene from the original Star Wars movie. You know the one I'm talking about, when R2-D2 projects a 3D hologram plea of the beautiful Princess Leia to Luke Skywalker and to Obi-Wan Kenobi.
You must see this droid safely delivered to him on Alderaan. This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
And now imagine you have your next teleconference in 3D, a hologram of you explaining to the rest of your company. It's on its way. Iowa State and Ames Lab engineers have been developing a real-time 3D teleconferencing technology. Joining us to talk about it, one of those engineers, Nicholas Karpinski, he's a PhD candidate at ISU in human-computer interaction and computer engineering. He's in our Ames studio. Nicholas Karpinski, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Now, how similar would this be to that scene in Star Wars when Princess Leia is standing there making her plea?
It's actually kind of funny. It's really, really similar, especially because when they were doing the original recording of it, you see the R2-D2 unit has a little bit of light projected onto her.
Yes.
And we're actually doing the exact same thing. It's only that we use infrared light, so you don't actually see the light.
Okay, so that beam we wouldn't see, but it's there. Our eyes can't see it, though.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit how this works quickly. I know it's very complicated because you use a lot of technologies here all working at the same time. How does it work? Give me the path.
So basically what happens is a user sits down in front of one of our systems. There's infrared light that gets projected onto the user, and then there's two cameras that record that infrared light that's on the user. And then the cameras look at that light and see how the shape of the person actually distorts the light. And then based on that distortion, you can infer what the actual shape of the object is, in our case, the user. That gives us the 3D information. And because we have two cameras, we actually get 3D information from two different views. So we get a really wide field of view around our user. From there, then what we do is we make that into one holistic mesh. We compress that, stream it across the network, and then redisplay on the holographic display on another node.
Okay, so that would be a desktop size of you or me if we were we to be projected, right? Are we talking
Correct.
Life, not life size?
The only reason why it's not life size is the projector that we have currently for the actual physical display, the visible light one, mm-hmm. is just a really small short throw projector. It was just something we had.
We got about a minute or so left, Nicholas. Now we need to get to the why. Why do we need this? After all, simple voice teleconferencing, not even video, is enough for most situations. Why do we need 3D apparitions talking to us in business settings?
It's a great question. One of the big things in communication is nonverbal communication, especially if you're, let's say, trying to sign on $1 million deal. You know, you want to be able to look the person in the eye, establish some sort of rapport, some sort of trust. And so if you look at just 2D video conferencing, let's say like Skype or FaceTime,
yep.
when you actually talk to that person and they talk to you and you're both looking at each other, it looks like you're looking down at your keyboard, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And with this, because we have that extra dimensionality of data, we can actually transform the data so that you get that correct view again. So if I look at you and you look at me, we actually make mutual eye contact.
Mm-hmm. Also good for checking out if people are telling you the truth. You could walk around to the back side of them and see if they're crossing their fingers. Anyway, very quickly, we have a few seconds. The cost, and when is it available?
Currently, the hardware is about $20,000, and we're looking to release the software open source, hopefully within the next couple of months.
Okay, thank you very much, Nicholas Karpinski, a PhD candidate at ISU in human-computer interaction and computer engineering. May the force be with you, Nicholas.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll return after a short break. Talk about Gold Star honors for two Iowa veterans who died in military service, one during World War II, the other in Vietnam. Also, a look at the Wild Rose Independent Film Festival going on currently in Des Moines. This is River to River, a NewsBuzz edition. I hope you're buckled up. We'll be back in just a minute with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad you're along for a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Two soldiers are honored and remembered each year at the Gold Star Hall's Gold Star Ceremony at Iowa State University through personal stories and photos. On years like this one, when there are no new names to add to the wall, thankfully so, we should say, of course, two soldiers whose names are already engraved in the Gold Star Hall are honored. And this year, James Lee Merrick Jr., who died in Vietnam, and Robert Lynn Hodson, who died in World War II, will be honored. And this year's observance will take place today at 3:15 in the afternoon. Kathy Sveck is with us. She's Gold Star committee member and a ceremony coordinator. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Ben.
Welcome back to our program. Let's talk about these two heroes, the men who gave their life for our country. Let's start, if we could, with our World War II veteran, Robert Lynn Hodson. Tell us about him.
Well, Robert, known as Bob, was involved in probably one of the most historic missions during World War II. He was, as we know, an Iowa kid, grew up in and around Eldon, Iowa, attended Iowa State 37 through 40, and then enlisted in the Army and was commissioned in 1941. Now, his interest was in flying, and he became a navigator after having been trained by the Pan American Navigation School in Miami. Well, he was assigned to a field in England and was training on a B-17 to do bombing missions.
Mm-hmm. And these are the famed Flying Fortresses.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Robert was a part of a crew that was assigned to a very important mission in Germany. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, you were going to tell us about the mission he was on when he died.
That's right. The Allies were trying very hard to cripple the manufacturing capacity of Germany, and they had identified the location of a plant making ball bearings. And the ball bearings, of course, are essential equipment for any kind of machinery. And they were determined to disable this particular manufacturing plant, which was located in Schweinfurt, Germany. So on October 14th, 1943, Hodson's B-17 was one of 291 B-17s dispatched on this very important
mission.
Imagine
that, almost 300 of these, plus the B-24 Liberators taking off.
Absolutely. The rumble in the sky as they roared out over England and across France into Germany must have been terrifying, actually. The Germans were well aware. This was a daylight raid, and so the Germans were well aware that they were on their way. And they were able to assemble their anti-aircraft crews on the ground, and they were able to dispatch their fighters. Now, there was a little bit of an anomaly during World War II. The bombers did leave England with a fighter escort, but the fighters did not have the range that the B-17s did. So there was a moment, usually when they crossed over the border into Germany, when the fighters had to turn back, and the bombers went on alone. And so the German Air Force just simply waited for the American fighters' escorts to leave, and then they really dove in and began defending the facilities on the ground. So it was pretty rough for this huge contingent of B-17s once they were headed for their target. Of course, the B-17 was well-armed, but they weren't as quick as the little fighter plane. Mm-hmm. So the German defenders were serious, and they really were inflicted heavy damage on the American crew. But Hodson's plane actually survived the anti-aircraft fire, delivered its bomb load, and was on its way home when it was hit and very badly damaged. Two of the engines in Hodson's plane were disabled, and Hodson was severely injured and died in an explosion that smashed the cockpit.
The rest of the crew made it back. It was mentioned October in 1943, known as Black Thursday. When I look at this, this strike on Regensburg and Schweinfurt cost the U.S. Army Air Corps 60 of the B-17s, 55 air crews, a total of 552 men. Hard to imagine the loss that you can occur in one raid. Of course, heavy casualties inflicted on the Germans as well.
As well.
Yeah. We have just a couple minutes. Please tell us about the other honoree, James Lee Merrick, Jr.
James Lee Merrick, a boy who grew up in Ames, was a third-generation aviator. His grandfather and father were both flight instructors. And after James graduated from Iowa State in 1965, he enlisted and became a pilot. He was a part of a squadron that was doing photo reconnaissance flights over North and South Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And they would fly over conflicts on the ground after the strikes to see what was going on with the enemy. And so some of those missions were quite dangerous. Now, Jim died. He was his plane was dispatched from an aircraft carrier. And it was it's a very, very dicey and difficult maneuver to get a plane back onto an aircraft carrier. And Jim died in a terrible accident trying to land after a very routine flight. So these things happen during warfare, and it's a very sad occasion.
Tell us, what are the requirements that are there, the criteria for having a gold star put in someone's name on the hall there at ISU?
We just need to verify that the person was enrolled at Iowa State on a full-time basis for some period of time. They needn't have graduated. They just needed to have attended as a full-time student. And so that they have to have that connection. They also need to have been in an active combat area as defined by the Department of Defense.
And during this ceremony, personal stories, photos there to be seen as well this afternoon.
And the families will be there.
The families will be there.
Okay,
yes. Well, what is the ceremony? Briefly, what is this? What happens during the ceremony?
We have wonderful participation from the ROTC cadets. There will be a color guard. There will be addresses from university representatives, military science representatives, and the director of the union. And then the bulk of the ceremony really deals with the stories of the individuals. We really try to make them come alive just for a few minutes and to get a real understanding of who they were.
This year's observance open to the public starting at 3:15?
3:15 today, absolutely.
Kathy Zivek, thank you so much. Gold Star Committee member, ceremony coordinator, and honoring this year James Lee Merrick Jr., who died in Vietnam, and Robert Lynn Hodson. Kathy Zivek, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Well, it's a good little time to give a preview of our Veterans Day specials coming up on Monday for IPR listeners. Monday at 10 a.m. instead of Talk of Iowa, we'll hear an hour-long documentary, The Uniform. And Rick Fredrickson has created this documentary. He's in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Rick.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Let's get a brief preview of what you're doing during this hour. Which wars do you feature in this hour-long documentary, The Uniform?
Well, we go all the way back to the Civil War. The sesquicentennial of the Civil War was last year, and we had done a news story about that. There's a group called the Civil War Roundtable, and so we kind of going to peer into that era of veteran in Iowa, and we go all the way through the major wars, World War I, World War II, Vietnam. We hear from a Korean War veteran. And even some of the most recent National Guard men and women who went to Afghanistan in that 2,800-person deployment a couple years ago. So we cover a lot of ground by examining some of the greatest moments in our country's history.
And I wonder, in putting this documentary together, what have you noticed some major differences between the veterans of earlier wars that you mentioned and the more recent ones, Iraq and Afghanistan?
Maybe it's not so much the differences, but the similarities. And that's kind of what we're bringing all of this together in a program titled In Uniform. It doesn't matter whether you were deployed during war or during peacetime, if you were a WAC in the Women's Army Corps or a man in the Army or in the National Guard. You all served in uniform, and it's our way of performing a tribute for them. But they all fought or at least served our country during all of these wars. One of the women that we hear from covered Camp Dodge during World War I. And she was asked, of course, I wasn't there at the time, but she was asked, were the men upset? Was there any division about them stepping up? And she says, oh, no, they were just all so energetic and excited and almost to the point of looking forward to going to war. I guess we could contrast that with what happened in Vietnam. And yes, there are differences, but we're trying to focus on the similarities for the program In Uniform.
Rick Fredrickson, your documentary to air at 10 a.m. on Monday, In Uniform, also has some archive audio here. The first A-bomb test covered by a man named Jack Shelley. We have a little bit of the audio of that test, but for listeners unfamiliar with that name, tell us, who was Jack Shelley?
Yeah, Jack Shelley was sort of like the Edward R. Murrow of Iowa. Later in his career, he was a journalism professor at Iowa State University. Prior to that, he was the news director at WHO Radio and Television. And it was during that time that some of our local radio reporters were actually sent overseas to the front line and covered World War II. Jack Shelley was among those. And we have a pretty good segment on the Cold War, which really was our longest conflict in history. It's one of my favorite parts of the program because I was, like maybe like you, Ben, I was a young boy, and I remember the duck and cover rehearsals that we used to have to do in the hallways of our school. But it was during that time that Jack Shelley covered some historic moments in the war, including 60 years ago, exactly this year. He was there during a live test of an atomic bomb explosion when they were still being detonated above ground.
Okay, let's listen to this audio from your documentary In Uniform.
3, 2, 1. There's the bright light with my eyes shut. I can see that tremendous light. The earth is shaking underneath me. Not too bad.
There's the sound. There is the tremendous sound. This trench is being filled with dust.
People often asked, about the health of the folks who witnessed that. They were just a couple of miles away. The only one I know about is Jack Shelley, and he lived until he was 98 years old. So didn't apparently impact him. But we have been just a bunch of these historic audio interviews, old radio news clips that just really kind of make this one-hour special pop. And it's very listenable, we're really proud of it.
Well, Rick Fredrickson, it sounds like a wonderful tribute to our veterans on Veterans Day. Tune in for that Monday in place of Talk of Iowa. Rick Fredrickson, thanks for telling us about your hour-long documentary coming up on Monday, In Uniform.
Thanks, Ben.
Along with that special programming on Monday, this program, the Noon Hour, will feature stories of veterans as well. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure, actually the honor, of being able to join more than 80 veterans and others who took a day trip to Washington, D.C. on an Eastern Iowa honor flight. Now, that's arranged by volunteers who raise money through private and corporate donations. They send veterans on a tour of our nation's capital for free. The day included stops at the World War II Memorial, also the Korea War Veterans Memorial. And talk show producer Ben Stanton was along with me on that day a few weeks ago to help record the interviews, produce the program Iowans to get a little sense of what their military experience was like and what their reaction to seeing these memorials was. Ben Stanton joined me in the studio now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Quite an experience we had when we went on that, I believe it was a 7:37, very early in the morning to Washington, D.C.
It was a long day, but yes, it was quite an amazing experience to have, and we were so grateful to be along and to be able to share those stories with our listeners on Monday. There was some reluctance, I think, by the veterans at first to open up and share their stories. But as the day progressed, as we visited D.C., as we saw the memorials, as we saw the city, I think people were more willing to give a little bit. We have a little excerpt from one of the interviews you did at the World War II Memorial.
Bill Cassie, you said you're 94 years old. You served in World War II. You went into the Navy before Pearl Harbor, served for many years in several theaters in World War II in the Navy. We're standing here at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., right before a part of the memorial where in granite it says, "Here we mark the price of freedom." There are untold number of stars on the yes. wall here. Each of these stars, I think, represents 100 Americans
Isn't
who
that
died.
Hard to imagine?
Tell me your thoughts. That when you look at all these stars.
Yeah, you can't imagine that 100 for every one of those. Those are the guys. They're killed. They had no future. And I think those of us that are left over were just so glad we were alive, we didn't even want to think about it. So we didn't for a long time. So, and then later years, you begin to see that you better talk about it. They won't know what that means.
They won't know what "here we mark freedom. The price of freedom." They won't know that.
They won't know what freedom means or what we paid for it if we don't tell them. That's what I believe now.
I remember that conversation with Bill Cass, Ben Stanton. Also, though,
also some moments of humor.
Of course there were, you know, a lot of tough emotional moments that we had with the veterans. But you'll remember Mance King, a World War II veteran and bomber pilot. And, you know, as we just heard some of the stories about bomber crews and terrible situations that they were in. So tough stories, hair-raising stories from Mance King. But he kind of described war as a roller coaster. He also had a funny story.
War has so many aspects to it. It's a terrible thing, and yet there are very comical moments in it that just crack you up. You know,
comical?
Absolutely comical.
What would be a comical moment? You can remember?
Well, the time we bailed out, my navigator landed in a tree, a big oak tree, in the middle of a women's Air Force camp, and he was swinging back and forth in his parachute. And all these gals come running out of the barracks, you know, and they say, oh, may I feel your petticoat, you know? Old Shea was up there just grinning like a chessy cat, swinging back and forth.
What a great moment.
So, yeah, but both ends of the spectrum with the stories that we'll be sharing with listeners on Monday during that River to River show. But, you know, another aspect just wanted to quickly touch on, Ben, is that, you know, a lot of these veterans, especially the Korean War veterans, talked about when they came home, what kind of reception did they have? Well, not really any kind of reception. So this day, I think in some ways, what some of them were describing was it sort of served as a reception home.
It was a remarkable thing to have us experience, and we get to share that honor with Iowa Public Radio listeners at noon to 1 o'clock on Monday. Ben Stanton and I delivering with all the rest of our team here at Iowa Public Radio to you our best attempt at what it's like to experience an honor flight to Washington, D.C., a day trip. Thanks, Ben Stanton.
Thank you, Ben.
Finally today, the Wild Rose Independent Film Festival is in the midst of screening 45 films in competition during its 11th festival. Started yesterday, runs through next Thursday, November 14th, at the Fleur Cinema and Cafe. Joining us with a few brief words about it, Kimberly Busby, director of the Wild Rose Independent Film Festival. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, tell us, What kinds of films are screened at the festival this year?
Well, they're from all over the world. It's really exciting. We have films from Bahrain, the UK, Australia, Germany, and, of course, many from Iowa. So it's an international film festival.
Uh-huh. Now, how does having an international film festival in Iowa shape it?
Well, it's very interesting because all of these films are so diverse. That's the thing that I really appreciate is the diversity and the range of production values. Some are tiny little budgets, but everybody puts their heart and soul into these films, and they're wonderfully made. The production value is getting higher and higher every year. So I guess the digital revolution is worldwide as well because everybody has access to better equipment. So the movies are looking better. They have stronger actors, stronger directors each year.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, this has been going on. This is the 11th festival.
Yes.
11 years ago, what was the impetus to start this festival?
Well, I'm a filmmaker myself and an actor advocate teaching acting and producing plays and films. And I really wanted to give filmmakers a venue and a place to actually show their films worldwide, filmmakers coming to Iowa to make Iowa a global destination for an independent film festival.
We've got a couple minutes left. I know that 45 is too many to talk about,
yeah.
and they're all outstanding in their own ways, but tell us about a couple of them.
Sure. I want to plug tonight. We have some great comedies. We have Copay by Paul Burge and Joe Clark's hysterical film, The Formula. He just got distribution deal for that. And then a wonderful feature film tied to one of our key presenters. It's called 23 Minutes to Sunrise by Jay Kanzler. It has Eric Roberts and Nia Peoples in it. And Jay's doing a workshop on the following morning, Saturday, for actors auditioning for indie film. And the actors are bringing in monologues, and he's going to give them feedback, and they'll make some adjustments. And we are taking observers for that auditioning workshop, so that's exciting. And on Sunday, we have Rana Prince, who's a wonderful, a world-renowned intuitive counselor and speaker. She has the film Sacred Journey of the Heart, which screens on Saturday. And that film is about scientists and teachers and wise indigenous leaders from all over the world comparing their views on how we're all literally connected through the human heart on a vibrational level and how that impacts the planet. And Rana's really strong film is tied to her workshop, which she does on Sunday afternoon, called the Radical Forgiveness Circle Ceremony, which is going to be held at Unity Church. Everything else is at the Fleur Cinema and Cafe. Mm-hmm. We have awards. We have a great documentary called Thunder about Farron, the folk singer, that's produced by Iowan Leslie Gerhart. We have the feature film Molly's Girl that's coming up on Sunday and Tuesday evenings. The first time it's got a theatrical screening of the completed film about a gay rights activist who hooks up with a girl whose father is a conservative senator against gay marriage.
Mm-hmm. Kimberly and, Busby, we've run out of time.
All right.
Time enough to give us, because you've whetted our appetite so well, tell us where people can find out more online.
WildRoseFilmFest.com has all of the things that are being featured at the Wild Rose.
Kimberly Busby, good luck with this year's Wild Rose Independent Film Festival taking place in Des Moines. It's a pleasure having you on
the
program.
Thank you so much, Ben.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help in Des Moines from John Pemble today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And do tune in Monday for our special programming, that Eastern Iowa Honor Flight from noon to 1 o'clock. On Veterans Day. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.